الشعب السوري ما بينزل بيان رقم واحد اكيد هيك ما حنضل بيان رقم واحد من حرام بلشت البشاير بيان رقم واحد للشعب السوري ساير.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist and explorer, and a founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He's had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel and insurgent groups, and his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Kill the Messenger, What Russia Taught Syria. When you destroy a city, make sure no one, not even the story, gets out alive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young-Pelton.
Hey, good afternoon, Ian.
And you, in your foreign policy piece, you start out by talking about when you were in Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, and you were with the Chechen rebel commander, that you left the safe house with him to go into an area, a bombed-out area, about 15 minutes away, and then you fired up, put a battery in your satellite phone. He made a quick call, and then immediately you got out of there, took the batteries out of there, and no sooner were you out of that place than the Grad rockets came in, which of course indicates that the Russians were targeting satellite phones. And clearly you and your Chechen rebel that you're with understood that. I understand that when you were leaving Chechnya, you ran into Marie Colvin, the woman who was killed recently in Syria. And she asked you to brief her on how to stay alive, and you did. But curiously, it sounds like she didn't follow the advice you gave her in Syria.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that the Chechen War was the first of the dozen wars that I've covered where I saw journalists specifically being targeted and being killed. The telephone call that the Chechen commander made on my behalf was actually looking for a Frenchman named Brice Fletcher who had been kidnapped just before I went in, and was found later chained to a basement. So it was an ugly war, and it was very clear that journalists had no safe harbor. When I came out, and you have to remember, after a very long period of being attacked and surrounded, and there was little mercy shown to my compatriots, I met with Marie, and I told her that this was not your regular war. This is something, as soon as you fire up that sat phone or you make a phone call, they are going to start hunting you down, and they're going to stop either firing rockets at you or else dropping bombs on you. And she clearly understood the risk. And I think, to be fair to Marie, I think she was aware of that when she was in Syria, but she didn't actually believe that the Syrian government would fire rockets at the media center to kill her. Because you have to remember, she was on television the night before she was killed, talking to ITV and Anderson Cooper, and basically saying to people that she was staying in the media center.
Well, the media center, though, was also rebel headquarters, wasn't it?
Correct. And, I mean, these are sort of the terminology that we have to be careful of, because obviously the rebels are using journalists to broadcast messages and images of dead babies and, you know, shelled civilians. But, you know, that's the job of journalists. I mean, it's up to us to decide whether that's right or wrong or good or bad. But when a legitimate government decides that it's going to kill those messengers, even though they're not combatants, it does change the rules a little bit.
So what is there, though, to indicate that the Russians have trained the Syrians in this technique? Because the Russians didn't want anybody covering the Chechen War. That's pretty clear. Anna Politkovskaya, the journalist who made a reputation for covering it, was poisoned on a plane going down there, almost died, and was subsequently murdered on Putin's birthday. So there's no question that the Syrians have the same attitude. They won't let journalists in the first place. And just the other day, they wouldn't let in the human rights, UN's human rights monitor, who apparently has finally been let in. And Kofi Annan is now waiting to be let in. And apparently this footage that British television broadcast of Syrian troops going through a hospital, murdering people in the hospital beds, has been authenticated. So there's no question what is happening in Syria are crimes against humanity. And I imagine the war criminals that are doing it don't want the world to see.
Well, Ian, you have to look at the tactics. I mean, these tactics are not new. They've been ever since Attila the Hun made, you know, mountains out of skulls. But what you're seeing is almost a textbook copy of what the Russians did in the Second War. You know, they had their heads handed to them in the First War, literally. In the Second War, what they decided to do was essentially to silence, in other words, cut off all the cell phone communications, stop any communications, surround the city, pulverize it with artillery, allow a small window for some civilians to escape, and then pulverize the rest, and then go in and what they call jakisto, or cleansing, go in and arrest and execute a large number of military-aged males, plus any suspects that they wanted to identify. These are tactics that the Russians use, but, you know, are Russians doing it? No. But Syria is purchasing $1 billion worth of weapons from Russia. There are at least, you know, over a dozen documented Russian advisors in Syria now helping them with tactics and strategies. And it is, like I say, a textbook copy of what the Russians did successfully in Grozny against a very similar type of uprising.
So, again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Kill the Messenger, What Russia Taught Syria, When You Destroy a City, Make Sure No One, Not Even the Story, Gets Out Alive. Now, the Qataris and the Saudis seem to be arming the Free Syrian Army, and they've been doing so for some time. In fact, I believe the Qataris have sent in a brigade in there. But in your article at Foreign Policy, Robert Young-Pelton, you mentioned that Qatar provided 3,000 satellite phones to the Syrian rebels. So I guess that indicates, one, that satellite phones are incredibly important, and two, what you just said is they're also important to the Syrian government to use them for targeting.
Right, and the only reason I wrote this article at the request of Foreign Policy was they also saw some very striking similarities between what I would call information operations. In other words, direct targeting of people who provide information, whether it's being rebels with propaganda or civilians with horror stories, or even the journalists who are brought in by the rebels to cover the story. And Syria clearly sees that as a major threat to what they call the Libyanization of the conflict, where, you know, in Libya we had a very unpopular leader and international forces decided to get behind the rebels, and that same media machine was used to turn them into freedom fighters. Now you're seeing, you know, these guys in Syria being turned into terrorists and Wahhabists and Saudi-backed fundamentalists. And that's essentially what Russia did in Grozny with the Chechens. They took a group of people who were part of the Soviet army before the breakup and decided to call them all terrorists. And it's a very ugly, complicated information war. But I see the exact same hallmarks in Syria.
So is that to say that the Russians are not just advising the Syrian military, they're also advising the Assads in terms of propaganda?
Yeah, I mean, if you read the Russian media, you know, forget the Western media, and look at what Putin is saying about Syria and about the need for Western governments to stay out, you can see whose side. I mean, there's a huge split forming, you know, between Russian-backed governments like Iran and Syria, and of course Western-backed intentions. And Hillary Clinton was sort of caught sitting on the fence, being interviewed by CBS, and not really knowing who the rebels are, and not really wanting to make an opinion either way. And this is one thing that's very important: is that when people like Marie Colvin get killed, and they send up passionate stories of dead babies and slaughtered civilians, sometimes the poll numbers overtake the politicians' facts, and we get pushed into engagement in these wars.
So Putin's a big player here, because not only is he advising his Syrian surrogates, and it does feel like to some extent a sort of a revival of a Cold War proxy war, but Putin, of course, was the one who prosecuted the Second Chechen War. He blew up the apartment building in Moscow in order to, as a provocation to get the country into this war, and micromanaged it himself. So he's certainly the right person to be able to give them advice.
Yeah, and then once again, I reflect Putin's goals, which is to create sort of his orb of influence, against our goals, which is to create democratic institutions. And in the middle is this sense of, you know, do we want the Muslim Brotherhood to run Egypt? Do we want Saudi-backed Islamists to run Syria? And it seems like we're almost not part of that conversation anymore.
Well, already, I think, didn't Hillary Clinton sort of indicate that whereas the United States is not prepared to send arms, and as you know, Robert Young-Pelt and John McCain called for the use of the U.S. Air Force to target Syrian tanks, which, of course, is an absurd non-starter. But Secretary of State Clinton indicated that the U.S. wouldn't be sending any arms, but other people are, and that they, I guess, they're turning a blind eye to the Saudi and the Qatari arms that are flowing into the Free Syrian Army?
Well, you're seeing a slight shift because the U.S. has no problem using proxies or you know, friendly states to stand up. I mean, we hid behind the NATO shield in Libya. We didn't really bang our drum until it was over. But we spent, $1 billion dropping bombs on Libyan weapons. And if we do stand for human rights, I don't see any problem with making a public stand about what needs to be done and what we think should be done, and supporting countries who we normally don't get along with in arming rebels or at least helping people get their freedom. But here's the point. I mean, the point is that we are making decisions in a vacuum. You know, once the journalists are scared out of Homs and those regions, we don't know what's going on, so we can't make intelligent decisions. So even today, a war rages in Chechnya, even though they have shiny apartment buildings and a government, and Putin apparently won a mass victory in the recent election. But I don't know who to believe anymore.
Well, if you have the Russians hands-on arming and advising the Syrian regime, and on the other side, you have the Saudis and the Qataris covertly supporting the Free Syrian Army, Turkey right next door sitting on the fence, the United States sitting on the fence, Israel sitting on the fence. It seems like a one-sided proxy war.
Well, you know, there's always the wild card. For example, Syria was supposed to be a somewhat moderate quasi-dictatorship like, you know, Saddam Hussein was in Iraq, and you saw how that flipped around. So what I see here is a dramatic upheaval in who actually runs the Middle East, and for once it might actually be Islamic or Muslim countries or even Arab countries making their own decisions in that region and not bothering to ask us for our advice, as you see with Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who arbitrarily made the decision to send weapons and support into the rebels.
So do you think then that President Obama in his press conference today, Robert Young-Pelt, said that Assad would eventually go? What do you think the U.S. policy is, to let the others carry the water and the Syrian people are going to bleed for a while and eventually Assad will go and his Russian backers presumably will be pretty unhappy about it?
Well, the ugly truth is that Syria pays their rent checks with about 30% of its income coming from oil. And it's always better to deal with the dictator you know than the dictator you don't know. The danger card here is that when you look at Saudi Arabia and other countries that have the same inequities inside them, the U.S. has to draw a line somewhere. Who are we going to support and who are we going to let fall? And Syria is really, to me, the linchpin. If we are going to support Syria, we have to actually explain why we have supported Syria or not supported Syria in the past. Right now we have sanctions against them. They're supposedly bad boys. But do we also look at the alternative, and are we explaining to the population what happens if we do or don't support the rebels or the Syrian government? I don't see that kind of conversation going on.
Well, I spoke a few weeks ago with Bob Baer, who's in touch with the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, the leadership, and they were complaining to him. He told me they were complaining to him that the State Department won't talk to them. And Bob said, well, what are you guys going to do once you win against the Alawites? And this Brotherhood guy said, we're going to kill them all. To which Bob said, well, little wonder the State Department doesn't want to talk to you.
Well, this is the reality of revolutions and insurgencies. You know, you're always dealing with the most hardcore elements, but you know, one thing I see happening in Syria is where the Syrian army was essentially a group of military people who rebelled and were fighting a fairly military war. And now what you're seeing is that war turning more into a fundamentalist type of jihad. And, you know, had we engaged these people when they were sort of normal Western structures rather than let it drop into the sort of endless jihad type war that these things turn into, we might have had a political solution.
But Assad didn't allow for any space. As soon as any protest reared its head, he squashed it ruthlessly.
Well, but you have to understand, once America gets in via NATO or any other mechanism, and his tanks start exploding, those dictators pay attention because that military is the one that keeps them in power. And if they start vaporizing at a rapid rate, they will quickly come to the negotiating table or be kicked out of power. You saw that with Gaddafi, where you just basically vaporized his entire military, so he had nothing to do. But I just see that we have to have a very clear understanding of what we want to do with Syria. You know, I'm not backing the rebels or the Syrian government. I'm just saying that our government is waffling and watching these humanitarian crises unfold. And when the media goes in and tries to expose these things, Syria brutalizes these people until they don't cover it anymore. So once we have that vacuum, then the State Department doesn't have any pressure.
Well, that's clearly the situation it is today. But the alternative of repeating what happened in Libya doesn't seem to be on the cards, does it? I mean,
the alternative is Chechnya. You know, Chechnya was a breakaway republic. It had an election that was monitored. It had a non-fundamentalist government. Yes, it had criminality and terrorism, et cetera, but it was a functioning state. And when Putin went to war against it on the second war, he decided that there was a group of fundamentalist insurgents and had to wipe out most of the country. And we've seen those amazing satellite photos of before and after, which look very much like the before and after photos that Human Rights Watch published of Homs and Bab al-Mandeb.
Well, that's your suspicions that of the Russian hand in being involved in what's happening in Syria in terms of of the tactics. So who's going to step in then if the U.S. is going to waffle? And if, as you say, Robert Young-Pelton, the press have been pretty much intimidated into getting out of there because of what happened, because the Syrian military are actively targeting the press. They want them out. They don't want any witnesses. So if nobody covers it and it continues to go, and the Syrian army is now moving against, I mean, they're moving piecemeal against the rebels, aren't they?
But for example, what you're saying is Saudi Arabia, who is not known to be a major overt supporter of insurgencies, pouring money into Syria. And that's a fairly formidable ally. And then you've seen Qatar, which, once again, another oil-rich, family-run country, pouring significant resources and weapons and funding into a revolution. And obviously there's a price to pay once you take that money. But I'm just saying that we're seeing the roots of a different type of Middle Eastern support system.
So at the end of the day, then, when the president says that eventually Assad will be toppled, it's not going to be by the U.S., it's going to be by the Saudis and the Qataris?
Right, and then you're going to have to deal with a completely different animal when it comes to negotiating who gets their resources and oil and who runs the country. And once again, these decisions could have been made now as opposed to after the fact.
Well, one thing that won't happen if the Saudis have any say is the Arab Spring, right?
Yes. I mean, the idea of family-owned empires dropping like flies is not a favorable concept to the Saudis or the Qataris.
Well, isn't that the amazing kind of irony here? One family regime in Saudi Arabia gets rid of another family regime in Syria?
Yeah, but I think that is what we're seeing. We're seeing a slightly different ship. We sort of messed it up in Iraq, and you're seeing these Gulf nations take more control over the future of their region, which means we have less control in deciding who runs these countries.
So just in closing, let's talk a little bit about going back to Marie Colvin, who you knew, and particularly you knew her from the Chechen War, which is what we've been talking about here, the similarities between what happened in Chechnya and what's happening in Syria now. And you advised her on how the Russians were targeting the use of cell phones, and clearly that's what happened in Syria, that the cell phones, the satellite phones were used there. CNN seems to have sort of, didn't they have a long interview from the very same place?
I mean, it actually started with Darwa Damon. Darwa Damon, she was broadcasting from the same building and live, and it wasn't any secret where she was, and they flattened the top floor of the four-story building after he left. So that was a clear message to any journalist I wanted to broadcast from there. Marie and other journalists came in after that, and then once again very publicly went on television internationally and in print and radio, and very specifically said where they were staying, and then the next morning they finished off the building. So it wasn't any surprise or any great secret.
What explains it to you that for a veteran war correspondent like that, who wasn't suicidal or reckless, she was apparently a very courageous woman, but
I think based on my experience, you get caught.
Sorry, can you repeat that? Your phone's breaking up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's still breaking up. Yeah.
Let's try this again. How's this?
Better. Yeah.
Okay. I think what happens is you get caught up in the tone of the event. You're with a bunch of survivors. You're getting continually bombarded with rockets and bombs, and you sort of develop this what the hell kind of approach. And so I just felt from the way she talked and the anger in her voice and the topic she was focused on that she was just angry. She wanted the message and the images and the concept of complete brutality to get out there, and she was willing to pay the consequences. And, you know, she was 50, in her mid-50s, so she probably thought, you know, if she heard rockets coming in, or, you know, she could escape them, but she didn't. Apparently she got killed going back to get her shoes and the rockets landed, so she could have survived.
Well, I understand that prior to the rockets coming in, that she had witnessed a young child who had a shrapnel wound to the stomach die in front of her.
Right, and that was the day before, and I think she wanted to get that message out. It was very important to her to go as wide and as deep as she could with that story, because she felt that people needed to take action. And it's a common theme in journalism to say that nobody's doing anything, these people are dying. And it's also exacerbated by the people in these places who are essentially terrified and feel like the world is ignoring them. So journalists tend to adopt that same tone and don't really think about the consequences, and she paid the ultimate price.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Young-Pelton.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I mean, speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He's had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups, and his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and The War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Kill the Messenger, What Russia Taught Syria. When you destroy a city, make sure no one, not even the story, gets out alive. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not Netanyahu and the neocons have been dissuaded from going to war against Iran.